Welcome to Dispatch in Depth, where we give you the stories behind the science of emergency dispatch. This is the official research podcast of the International Academies of Emergency Dispatch, the world's leading authority in dispatch science. I'm your host, Isabel Gardette, Director of Academics for the International Academies of Emergency Dispatch. In each episode, we'll be bringing you stories of the fascinating people who do research in this area. We'll give you their backstory, including how they got there, what they're working on, and what drew them to the research. These are people who represent the cutting edge in dispatch research, and I hope you'll join us to hear more about them. Welcome to Dispatch in Depth. Today's guest is a GIS, or Geographic Information Systems, professional living in Utah. She spent the majority of her career working with police, fire, and EMS, and she's currently the GIS lead on the Attorney General and Unified Police Department Child Abduction Response Teams. Over the course of her career, she has responded to many large-scale emergencies, including wildfires, floods, and missing persons. Welcome, Lindsay Bentley.
Hi.
So first of all, for those of our listeners who don't know, what exactly is GIS?
Well, the short answer is that it is making maps. The long answer is there's a lot more to it. It's kind of analyzing all the data behind, I guess, whatever kind of a map that you're making, or even just there's a lot of analysis or coloring, or a lot of people say I color all day.
But primarily map making, yeah. Locating things and... Mm-hmm. Okay. So how did you get interested in GIS? What interested you in this field, and how did you get where you are now?
It was totally by chance in college. I happened into a cartography class at Utah State University.
Which is map making?
Yeah, it's kind of the art behind making maps, you know, making sure that they look pretty, mm-hmm. you know, making sure that the colors are just right. Yeah, it's more the art behind it. And it was the only time in the 4 years that I was there that class was taught. And I loved it. It totally caught my attention. I always wished that I was a better artist than I am. And so maps became my art. That was what drew me in. And so after that, I took a lot of independent study classes. I had a professor that took me under his wing, and he got me into a whole lot of random classes, like with the pilots up at Utah State, to learn about the atmosphere and whatnot, and aerial photography.
And as I mentioned in the introduction, you've done a lot of work, you said, with police and fire and EMS. What is the role of maps or GIS or map making in those emergency fields?
So there's quite a bit. My first GIS job, I worked for a local municipality, and I mean, I was in charge of processing all the data and getting it ready to go into their 911 system. And so GIS's role in that is, you know, if you call 911 or you call your local dispatch center and they say, what is the address of your emergency? GIS is what helps them get to where you are. And so making sure that we have all the house numbers and street names and aliases and everything like that in the system so that they can pinpoint where you are. I ended up working quite a bit with their fire department. They wanted to create pre-plans of mobile home parks and apartment building complexes. There's not a universal addressing standard for those. With apartment complexes, you can have an address, like a house number, you can have a building number, you can have an apartment number or letter or any combination of the three. And so a lot of the times dispatch would be able to get them to the front gates, and then they were just driving around trying to find where they were going. And so obviously that was costing them precious time when they're trying to get somewhere. And then with mobile home parks, when they first set up, everything's in numeric order. But if you get three mobile homes that move out at the same time, whichever one fills first takes that next number. And so there were some that we drove around that had 200 or 300 mobile homes, but you could get mobile home 17 next to 69, next to 127, next to 5. I mean, they were just all out of order. And so they ran into a lot of issues there too. And I mean, I had a great time. Every time that crew was on shift, I would take my laptop or papers and hop in the fire engine and drive around and mark things. And then anytime they had a call, I got to go with them. And so I got to see what they do. But I think the turning point for me was one night, my phone rang. It was like 1:30 in the morning, and there was a very excited fireman on the other end. And he said, "We just got a call to this apartment complex, but we just drove around it last week and created that map with you. And if it weren't, like, we knew exactly where to go and how to get there." And they said, if we would have been 30 seconds later, she wouldn't have made it. And I mean, so that, I mean, that was definitely a feel good moment for me, knowing that.
Yeah,
I think that made a difference.
Yeah, that's something that comes up a lot when we talk to people in the public about 911. I think there's this belief that addresses just sort of are magically known, right? That when you call 911, they should just magically know where you are.
Right.
But somebody on the back end has to go around and do all this work. In fact, it's interesting to me to hear that you go out with the crews, because I think a lot of people would assume that working on GIS, working on map making, you're sort of in an office somewhere working with data. But you're saying you actually go out with the crews into the community and see the lay of the land. So what's the balance there? How much do you have to go out and actually see what's going on in the real world? And how much do you do kind of analysis work on your own?
I mean, I think it's personal preference. I mean, you could entirely stay all day in a room on a computer. I prefer to see and try and learn what their jobs are and what they're doing and why it's important to them, so I can figure out how to help them.
Mm.
It's easy to just crunch numbers on a computer and tell them it works. But unless you know how it's being used, it's hard to understand the importance of what you're doing and why it needs to be accurate or as accurate as possible.
And does seeing it in person actually help you make a better map?
I would say it does. I mean, there's a level of caring about your job if you're completely checked out and blasé about it and just wanting to crunch stuff and throw it out versus wanting to make sure that it's as accurate as possible and that you're really combing through it to make sure that it is where it needs to be. I think there's a big difference in the end.
And how did you get involved in working with EMS and firefighters?
That was pretty much it. I mean, but that lit the fire. I mean, that definitely helped me pinpoint what area, I guess, of the GIS world that interests me and that I like to work in. And so I carried that with me to my next employer. I did a lot of work again with their fire department and their police department. And then I was approached by an assistant chief of a larger local fire department. And he said that they were hiring their very first GIS person and that they needed somebody to build the system for them.
Interesting.
And we spent a lot of time talking. And of course, they were interested with all the work that I had done. I mean, this is an organization that spans two different counties. There's over 600 firefighters and 30 fire stations now. And so it was a big undertaking. And I was excited. Oh, it was great to go in and build it from scratch because I didn't have to fix anybody else's errors. That's terrible to say, but it's nice. It's exciting. A lot of people, I think, would be overwhelmed and think that it's a daunting task, but I was super excited about it and the opportunity to help on such a larger scale. And then on my first day there, I was being introduced in command staff meeting, and there, as soon as the meeting was over, I was approached by a lieutenant from the Unified Police Department. And he just pointed at me and he's like, "You," he's like, "We need you. We don't have anyone that does what you do." And so Sheriff Winder talked to my chief and they worked it out so that they were okay if I helped UPD at a moment's notice. And so that was how I got recruited onto their child abduction response team. That's been by far the greatest thing that I've been involved in my career.
So talk to us a little bit about that. How is a mapping person, a map analysis person, involved in a missing child case or an abducted child case? You said you get called at a moment's notice. So usually I think of mapping as something you do for the long term, or, you know, you have a map and then you kind of keep that to use. But it sounds like there's some part of your job that is involved in on the spot or in the moment response to situations. Is that the case?
Yeah, absolutely. So I was called out on a missing person. The most recent one was in July that I got called out on. It was a Saturday afternoon. I just put my daughter down for a nap. I was folding some laundry. It was super glamorous. And my phone rang, and it was an officer saying that they had a missing elderly man. And at that point, all that he had was the man's home address. And so he gave me that address. I pulled out my laptop. I started setting up search grids and downloading information for his area, just and putting it all together in my kitchen. And then about an hour later, he called me back with an address of where they were going to set up their command post. And so I left my house and headed out there. So typically a person is found within a quarter mile of where they were last seen. Obviously figuring out where they were last seen is the big, big key there. Mm-hmm. And so I've now created a quarter mile search grid for the entire state of Utah. There's 1.3 million of these grids and wow. over 13,000 just for Salt Lake County. And so we will, the first thing that I will do is figure out where that person lives, and then that becomes like the home grid. And if that's all that they have to go off of at that point is where the person lives, then that is where we start. That is where we start searching, and we just kind of start spiraling out from there grid-wise in printing areas. When I got out there, they had about 170 volunteers that had just shown up ready and willing to help. And so when we do volunteer searches, we try to keep it 10 people to a team with one officer leading the team. And so they will be given one of these quarter mile grids and then a whole bunch of paperwork where they can go out. They can walk around, look in the areas. They're not allowed to, knock doors, hop fences or anything like that. But if there's people out, they can hand them a flyer, talk to them, things like that. And then I track these grids as they're being sent out. And then as they're coming back in to try and figure out where we've been, where we've looked.
So you're getting real-time information back from the search teams.
Mm-hmm. Hmm. Yeah. And then there's coordination with, for that one, we had the Salt Lake County Search and Rescue Team, and they were doing their own searches. Sometimes we end up with a FEMA dog or a scent dog or a cadaver dog that can go out and look. And then also sometimes we get search and rescue helicopters, depending on the area. So there's a lot of coordination and there's a lot going on. This one was a little different for us because we had a lot of volunteers show up with drones.
Really?
Yeah. Saying, I have a drone. Can I put it up? Or where can I search, or where can I use it?
Was that the first time you'd seen volunteers show up with drones to do a search? That's interesting.
Yeah. Yeah. It was very interesting. It was kind of exciting, but it was also a heavily wooded area. Mm. So, we weren't real sure of where to send them. And then we also, some of the initial grids right around the person's home, we leave not really for volunteers and more for officers. Mm. And the officers that went out and did closer searches and were searching people's yards and whatnot, they kind of walked up and down the street and they knocked on every door of somebody that had like a Ring doorbell. And they asked those people to look at their footage between this and this time to see if that man had walked past their home. Hmm. And which was also interesting. So, that was a fun thing to track, who had these doorbells and who they've talked to. They ended up not finding anybody that had any footage of this man, which was discouraging for the officers. But to me, that was, we knew where to not look, right? We knew where to focus our search somewhere else. Yeah. Yeah. So it was very interesting.
Did they find him?
Yeah. Yeah. They did end up finding him.
And was he okay?
Yeah. Yeah. But it's been fun. And that would be, that department is different in that not everyone is, issued a smartphone. Mm. I think a lot of GIS people get hung up on wanting to make the most amazing, fantastical map that encompasses all of their abilities. And they totally lose what it is that the end user needs and wants. Mm. And that's key in your work. And in this particular case, that department, where they're not issuing smartphones and everybody doesn't have a smartphone, creating an online map wasn't necessarily right for that scenario because they didn't have, a work phone or a work issued anything like that they could look at and use and everything. Yeah. But they're moving that direction, and I created one anyway, and it was just a simple one with the grid over an aerial, and I would turn the grid green after the search teams would come back, and I sent that link at least to, the members of the command staff, and it blew their mind. They couldn't believe that they didn't have to come back to the command post to get an update on where they've been and where they've searched and what's going on.
And it avoids a lot of double work. People don't go back to the same areas. Right. They know where people have been.
Yeah.
That's very interesting. The idea that in rather than thinking about the map itself or what it's going to look like or what it's going to represent, you think first about the use that it's going to be put to or what the user needs. What's your process for that? So if you go into a new situation, let's go back to when you talked about setting up a new system for the fire department. Mm-hmm. Where did you start? I mean, who did you talk to? What kinds of questions do you ask to figure out what kind of maps they need and what uses they're going to have for it?
And that's where interacting with the people that you're working with or making a map for is key, right? Because I could create something amazing and make everything 3D and all this nonsense, but it wouldn't be applicable in that situation. Mm. And so you have to start talking to the people that you're working with and that you're making these maps for to understand what their need is and the end result that they're looking after. It was talking to a lot of people. It was working a lot of these natural disasters. I worked out of the Salt Lake County Emergency Operations Center, which would be spun up anytime there was a major emergency. So think about every spring where the east side floods, mm-hmm. and every summer where the west side burns, you know? I mean, so we were active quite a bit. And so being able to be there, see what's happening, see the reports and the paperwork and the things that they are doing and needing in that situation helps me figure out what to give them. Initially, there was a lot of time spent on the data for the dispatch center, mm-hmm. making sure that was accurate and correct. And at a county level, that required a lot of coordination with the local municipalities. They were also pretty big on making sure that they had paper copies of everything, which nowadays seems a little bit backwards, right? Because everybody's pushing to put everything online, which is great. But they also keep it in the back of their minds that we could get the big one at any time, right? The big earthquake that we're 50 years plus overdue for, mm-hmm. that we've been hearing about. And so they wanted to keep paper copies of everything up to date in case we did get it.
Right,
and
in case things go down.
Yeah, in case things go down. And the purpose of that was so that without computers or without internet, they could still have maps of their area with all of their key infrastructure.
Right.
And then also have copies to be able to hand it to outside agencies that might come in to assist. And so one of the big projects there that took up probably 2 or 3 months out of my year was updating a printed map book for the county and that streets and buildings and fire hydrants and, I mean, all parks, just about everything you can imagine that might be important. Yeah, so there's quite a bit that goes into it.
You said you worked some on wildfires. Mm-hmm. Can you tell us a little bit about, I mean, it makes sense for search and rescue. You have people going out. What's the role of a map or mapping in working a wildfire?
So in the FEMA world, there's a lot of paperwork and a lot of things. You have to track all of your assets as they go out. You need to track all of your personnel and their hours. Anytime there's a major event, you have the opportunity to submit paperwork back to the federal government to get reimbursed for all of your efforts and even for damages, right? There's different thresholds that you have to meet. And so, I mean, you set up your ops period and you have to make up reports for every period. And then that's just to track what's happened, who, where, what, when, why. And then you can pass it off to the next crew that might be coming on so that you can go sleep. Mm-hmm. So in a wildfire, I mean, we think about Harriman burns every summer, right? So we're going to track where crews might go. You're going to immediately look at possible infrastructure that would be threatened by the wildfire so that you can consider evacuation areas. And then also evacuating those homes, but setting up Red Cross centers or volunteer centers or places for people to take their livestock and their animals. You'll also track the fire line. You want to keep track of where it's burning, but then also keeping track of how much of it is contained, right? How much of it they've been able to keep
the same way as with the cleared areas for the missing person.
Yeah, so I had a captain that was a little rough around the edges. And there was one fire where command post was set up at a fire station, but they kept me at the EOC. They didn't want me to be, it was really close to the fire line at that point. So they had me stay away. And so I was working out of my office and I had a map runner and I would print all these maps and then they would take them to my captain. And there was one time, you know, my captain wanted to do a conference call or a video call. So I was in the back of a fully staffed EOC, started this conference call. And he holds up a map and he's like, what is this? Swear word, right? He's like, what is this? I don't need this. You know, what were you thinking? And it was like this big 48 inch by 48. I mean, it was this ginormous map. And he grabbed it and he crumpled it up and he made a big show of throwing it over your shoulder. And at that point, like the whole EOC got really quiet. And I looked at him and, you know, and I said, well, that was an infrared vegetation map of your fire line. And I thought it might be helpful because if the fire were to jump the line, you might be able to predict where it would go. And then you could set up. I mean, his face went white. His eyes got big. He turned around and he picked it back up and he spread it out on the table. Okay, now what is this? Like, please explain. I mean, it's different. You know, police and fire are typically trained to be quite reactionary to this, to the situations that they're in. And so sometimes, you know, kind of thinking out in the kindest way possible, thinking on a pre-plan type of a basis can be a little outside of their comfort, you know?
I love that he just immediately assumed this is of no use to me whatsoever. That's terrific.
Yeah, it happens a lot.
So on that same note, for dispatchers, for example,
yeah,
what do you wish that they understood about the maps that come to them? I mean, they sit down at their console and here's a map that they're using. What do you wish they understood about what goes into that?
Okay, so I had in my first job, the person that was in charge of dispatch came to me and she just screamed at me for like an hour telling me that she wanted me to prepare for every possible misspelling and mistype that her dispatchers might make while taking a call. And she's like, if somebody calls up and they say it's Easy Street, then I want it in there showing it's Easy Street. I mean, it was pretty intense. I mean, how do you prepare for every possible misspelling of a street name or every possible nickname?
And isn't it possible that the misspelling could actually be the real spelling of a different street?
Yeah, yeah, no, and it's totally possible. So there's definitely, there needs to be an accountability on the dispatcher's side to also learn their areas and learn the street names and learn their aliases and, you know, take the time to make sure that you are spelling and typing those things in correctly. I mean, every call, you know, time is of the essence. And so I think it's equally important for the dispatchers to become familiar with the areas that they are over as it is for the people that are preparing the data that goes into it. It would be impossible to come up with an alias table for every possible misspelling.
Yeah.
I mean, it would be absolutely impossible and a lot of work, and it could change and it would be different with every dispatcher and every person that would be there. Yeah. So, I mean, I think they have a really hard job. You know, they are talking to people in some really scary moments. I'm quite impressed with the dispatchers that I've met, being able to keep their composure and do their job and talk to the person calmly. I mean, I think that takes immense talent to be able to do that. And I mean, I really haven't met a dispatcher that doesn't care about their job and care about what they're doing. But yeah, so I would just, I guess, plead for them to get to know their areas.
You talked a little bit about misspellings or maybe places that don't have the same numbering systems. If you're putting together a map of a new area or you're thinking about a map in a new way, what's the biggest difficulty or complexity that you run into?
Man, I think the hardest thing to accept is that there will never be a perfect map, right? There is always going to be something incorrect. You've got human error, right? We all make mistakes. And then also there's a lot of unknowns. I think the rule that I've heard is that as soon as a map is printed, it's out of date because something has changed. And that can be a hard thing to accept, right? So even the 1.3 million quarter mile grids that I'm having to make for the entire state of Utah, you know, I'm making maps of areas I've never been to.
Right.
Using data that I don't know who made it. And I just really hope that it's correct and that it's up to date, which I, you know, I don't have any control over. And so it's definitely hard to, that can be a hard thing to swallow, especially because sometimes you don't find those mistakes until you're in the moment and you need it to be right. And then you find out that it's not. And that those are some rough moments. So, yeah, I think it's just hard to accept that every map will not be perfect. It's just not possible.
Yeah. So one of the things that we talk about a lot is that emergency dispatchers in many ways are really the managers of the system. So they sit at the hub and they determine where resources go. They determine what resources are going to go. They determine, so they act as sort of the incident commander for a lot of events until somebody gets there.
Right.
So you've talked a little bit about using GIS in the moment or setting up a system from the beginning. Where do you see GIS as being valuable in system management overall? Where can dispatchers maybe think about the geography or the map of their area in terms of system management rather than just event management?
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot. There's, I mean, anytime that you're creating a map, you've got your, you know, political boundaries. You also have natural boundaries. And those things change constantly, right? And in a dispatch system, are you responding zone to zone or are you responding by closest unit? And that seems to be, I think, the biggest debate in the dispatch world, whether it's going to be politically, you're going to send whoever, whatever jurisdiction you are in or that the call comes in, or whether you're going to send the closest unit. I understand it's all about money, right? And it all depends on, I guess, the level of involvement that they're allowed, because it may start in dispatch, but at some point they turn it over. And it's more, there's more than address points and street lines, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you've got trails that you could, that would be helpful in the system, as well as waterways. I was in a training one time and they said, well, it was a training, there's a program called Project Lifesaver.
Mm-hmm.
And it's this great program where they use these radio transmitters and they either attach them to the shoe or through like a watch band on an autistic child. It's just, it's awesome. It's amazing. It's done by a police officer. I mean, it helps the child get used to a person in uniform and recognize them as somebody that can, that's nice and kind and helpful, instead of possibly running away from people they don't know. But in that training, they told me that the autistic are drawn to water. And so anytime, and they don't know why, but anytime an autistic person has ran away or gotten lost, they tend to find them near a water source, which is fascinating.
Yeah, I've
but
never
nobody
heard
knows
that.
Why. Yeah. And so, I mean, but that's a very key piece of information to know if you are out looking for an autistic person, right? You're going to want to know where all of your lakes and streams and swimming pools and retention and detention basins, any kind of natural spring. I mean, those are the places that you're going to want to check first. So there's a whole lot of little things that can go into this.
Right.
You know, I mean, it seems so simple. You answer the phone and you take a call, but there's a lot that can help with the decision-making and how you run your system.
Hmm. So before we go, I'd like to just ask you one more question. And I think this is one that dispatchers will recognize. And you kind of touched on it a little before, but when you're dealing with a situation like, for example, a missing person, especially a missing child, or maybe a wildfire that's currently destroying homes or what have you, how do you manage the relationship between knowing that that's a high pressure, high stress, potentially dangerous situation, and having to get the data right and be very careful in your analysis?
Yeah. I mean, really, practice, man, you just got to practice. I mean, when you are in those scenarios, you want your training to kick in and block out your nerves, right? Because you don't want to be thinking about how nervous you are and, oh my gosh, what is happening? You want your training to kick in and you want that to become almost mechanical, right? You're in that scenario. You know what you need to do and you're going to get it done.
Mm-hmm.
Training is key. And so finding those scenarios where you can train and have it become second nature. You know, if you are looking for, I mean, I know that dispatchers do a lot of training, but I mean, if I think for dispatchers, and I don't know what their rules are, but go on a ride along, you know, go on a ride along with your local police department and your fire department. Sit in your local emergency operations center, see what they're doing. I mean, that's how I learned, but it's helped me in my work to understand better what it is that I need to give, you know, the product that I
right.
need to give. And so, I mean, I would recommend that. Like, if you can spend time with the people that you may never meet on the other end of a radio,
Right.
You know, learn what they're doing so that you can learn why it's important what you're doing and take pride in what you're doing, then I would do that.
Okay. Well, thank you very much for being with us.
You're welcome.
Thanks for listening to Dispatch In Depth. Remember, it really helps us if you rate and subscribe on iTunes, Stitcher, SoundCloud, or wherever you get your podcasts. Dispatch In Depth is hosted by me, Isabel Gardette. Our producer is Becca Barris. Reading Roberts is the technical director, and Scott Robinson is our executive producer.